Hi, I'm Olivia.
And I'm Catherine.
And this is
The Blue Eye of the Beholder.
With us today are Kazia and Salma.
I am Kazia. Thanks for having me today.
I'm excited to be here.
Great. Today we're going to be discussing the origin of Western beauty standards and their modern impacts through a literary lens.
You know, something that I've thought a lot about is where do we get our beauty ideals from? Does it come from colonization or does it date back even further than that?
I know what you mean. I feel like beauty standards seem to value European features over others. I mean, to the point that non-European features are stigmatized and considered unprofessional, ugly, and undesirable. Take, for example, this passage from Andy Ziesler's We Were Feminists Once. Quote, consider an incident at a 2007 Glamour magazine event called The Do's and Don'ts of Corporate Fashion, where one of the magazine's editors instructed the assembled female lawyers that afros, dreadlocks, and other political hairstyles were inappropriate and a definite don't. This speaks to the entrenched belief that words like professional refer only to white baselines of attractiveness. This can't help but suggest that people of color who don't strive for that standard squander their professional and social advancement, end quote.
So where does this start from? Does it stem from antiquity or what?
It has to be from antiquity. It definitely is found in Greek text, like in Heliodorus's writing, for example. Not only was he a Greek writer, but he was the author of Ethiopica, the longest readable text of the surviving ancient Greek world. The main character of Heliodorus's Ethiopica, Carclea, had black parents who were from Ethiopia. Carclea's mother was giving birth while admiring a painting of a white goddess who was so beautiful that Carclea was born white. And you know what? Instead of becoming an outcast, no one thought it was odd that she was born white from black parents.
And then, for instance, you can look at Achilles Tatius's Leucippean Clitophon. The titular character is described as having golden hair and ivory and milky skin. Achilles Tatius is an Egyptian author. We currently have no way of knowing what people looked like back then. Tatius wrote his story about characters from the Fertile Crescent, Babylon or Lebanon and Egypt. In the story, Leucippe is disproportionately beautiful compared to other characters, and she's lusted after constantly, kidnapped frequently, and is pretty one-dimensional as a character until the final sections of the book. I'm wondering if Chariclea and Leucippe are described as fair-skinned because the authors intended them to be, or if it's a concept that doesn't really exist in the English language.
Okay, but these interpretations are just that, interpretations. What we do know is that the Greeks and Romans used color words in a different way than how we do today. Often the use of color was meant to describe certain characteristics or emotions. In the article Black Achilles, Tim Whitmarsh explains that the Greek word chloros is used to describe plants, but may also be used to describe blood, tears, the color of a frightened person's skin, and other, quote, moist growing things, end quote. Another example of the uses of color in the ancient world is how people were painted in ancient art. Men in this art are depicted with dark skin in order to show their masculinity. Women in ancient art have lighter skin, which describes their femininity. This does not mean, however, that all men in the ancient world had dark skin and all females had pale skin.
But everyone isn't aware that these are just wrong interpretations. It can be understood that the colonization period also made European interpretations of classical art and literature a standard that no one questioned.
Right, and that reminds me, paintings by early European artists were always commissioned for the upper class families who were white, and the artists were also white. For example, in Leucippe and Clitophon, the first part of the book goes into detail about the painting of the Rape of Europa. The maiden is described as beautiful, and the other girls in the painting are described as being filled with joy and fear, with bare legs, pale faces, with distorted features, and eyes fixed on the sea, and lips parted as if they were going to cry out for fear. I believe there are groups of people that simply believe these paintings were exactly what people from the past looked like, when in reality, it was just what the artists and the patrons wanted. A lot of people just do not understand race in antiquity. So is this something that has affected beauty standards in the last 20 or so years?
I say yes. Yes, it has. I've never felt welcome in most museums as a black woman because I could never find myself in any of the art. I mean, was I not worthy to be painted? And even when I did see myself in the art, it was always in the art with historical references, So, like, paintings that depicted the civil rights movement or slavery, but I never saw a museum that featured art that highlighted the pure beauty of my skin tone. I always saw paintings of white women as queens. Oh, I definitely never felt welcome in beauty departments. When you walk down the beauty aisle in Target, you will come across the brand Yes Too. The skincare brand is a popular brand that always has a cartoon of a white woman using their product on their packaging. Whenever I walked down the aisle, I never felt like I was supposed to be taking care of my skin as a dark-skinned woman because I'm simply not represented by the brand. And this isn't the first time a skincare brand has chosen to do this. The makeup industry has been doing this for years.
You're right. Historically, makeup brands have provided many different variations of foundations for lighter skin tones, with only a few shades for people of color. This has only recently begun to change, thanks to brands like Fenty Beauty by Rihanna and Jeffree Star Cosmetics. Rihanna's revolutionary makeup debut featured 50 unique shades, which catered to most all skin tones. Jeffree's recent concealer launch consisted of 31 different shades, specifically addressing the lack of variety for different undertones. He specifically aimed to provide shades for lighter-skinned Latinx people with olive undertones, as he saw the makeup industry has not properly provided adequate shades for these people. Brands like these have made inclusive shade variety an expectation for other brands, although it could be argued that this should have been expected from the beginning. The lack of shades and foundation stems from the notion that whiteness equates to beauty, which then perpetuates pop culture standards of what beauty is.
I mean, don't get me started on finding my foundation shade if my shade is even in the store.
I mean, I think too that the beauty industry and beauty ideals are entirely trend-based. Andy Ziesler makes a point about the commodification of the beauty industry. Look at trends and who models our clothing. I mean, in the 90s, you see heroin chic and waifish women like Kate Moss taking the fashion industry by storm. And then the 2000s brought Brazilian bombshells, and the 2010s, doll-eyed British blondes. Vogue in 2014 announced that we were in the era of the big booty thanks to celebrities like Iggy Azalea and Miley Cyrus, who are very much white women. What does this say about women of color who have been long ignored by the industry in favor of white models and idealized sizes?
I believe Toni Morrison really tackles these questions and what they do to young girls in The Bluest Eye. Her protagonist, Bacola, longs to be beautiful, and for her, beauty is rooted in Eurocentric ideals. In the beginning of the book, Bacola admires a cup with Shirley Temple on it. Bacola even drank 3 quarts of milk out of it.
Yeah, that's a lot.
That's a lot.
I agree.
Shirley was considered so cute, according to Bacola and Frida. Then a discussion arose about the big blue-eyed baby dolls. They were popular gifts for little girls. Claudia hated her baby doll because it wasn't soft and she had no concept of motherhood. She had the desire to dismember it and said all the world had agreed that a blue-eyed, yellow-haired, pink-skinned doll was what every girl treasured. When talking about packaging labels, Pocola eats a lot of Mary Janes, a candy with a little white girl on its pale yellow wrapper, who had a smiling white face looking out into the world. Eating the candy was like eating the blue eyes.
Do you think that all the symbolism of ingesting the white icons was intentional to Pocola? I mean, do you think that she was in a way trying to emulate these white girls by using their products?
Oh, yes.
Without a doubt.
Yeah, definitely.
There are moments when Bacola prayed for blue eyes because she wanted them so badly. Imagine me only using those Yes Too face masks solely for the product to seep into my skin and turn my face white overnight so that I could look as radiant and beautiful as the women on their packaging.
And then what about Pacola's poverty? Throughout the book, I felt like she was chasing after these blue eyes, and this beauty to her was a way to make her extraordinary and elevate her out of poverty. But it was unattainable. There was no way she could ever have blue eyes in the way that she wanted them. And even Claudia saw that goal as repulsive and weird. She could not even fathom Pacola with blue eyes. Clearly, to Claudia, it was not blue eyes or blonde hair that made someone beautiful.
Well, that relates to how Leucippe was being chased by all of those men because of her beauty. Like you said, Pacola chased after that type of beauty, but I doubt she would have wanted to be chased after like Leucippe was. After all, each of these characters are either described as beautiful or ugly.
Right, and with Bacola, there's this inherent ugliness. She's not really given many physical characterizations. Morrison instead wants us to believe that she is an ugly little girl, perhaps due to her upbringing, her spirit, or something else. She has this longing to rise out of that status as undesirable. And then Caracalla is indescribably beautiful. She is inherently beautiful. There's not much detailed physical description on her either, and the reader is meant to just believe in her beauty or ugliness.
Yes, exactly. We are meant to have our own imagination of each of these characters. These authors have their own idea of what they look like, and we should have our own idea as well.
Just like we're supposed to look at these paintings from so long ago and stand there with googly eyes over their beauty. We don't even know why we think those famous paintings are beautiful.
I think it's also important to think about the parental figures in these stories as well. Piccola's father rapes her and she becomes pregnant at age 11. The whole final section of The Bluest Eye culminates in her losing the baby and withering away. Her eyes continue to serve as a major symbol in the book. She cannot get her eyes to disappear in her fantasies. She fixates on every pair of blue eyes she comes across, and her father, moments before he rapes her, cannot bear to look at her, quote, haunted loving eyes, end quote.
Toni Morrison even uses her knowledge of antiquity to inspire the writing of her own modern classics. Morrison also deploys this technique in The Bluest Eye by looking at the story of Persephone and Demeter. Tracy L. Waters argues in her essay on Morrison's use of the Persephone myth, quote, Morrison's reenactment of the Persephone-Demeter myth follows the same plot as most accounts of the mythic story. Piccola is abducted and raped and then undergoes a transformation of self that results in the creation of two distinct identities. Unlike Persephone, who is physically kidnapped, Piccola's abduction is mental rather than physical. Piccola, like many young black girls, becomes metaphorically abducted by the image of the white aesthetic, end quote. So do you think that if she was blonde-haired and blue-eyed that this would have happened to her?
I think Piccola would have said no, but I think that if she were a white little girl in the same kind of family, it in all likelihood would have still occurred. Poverty, although affecting people of color disproportionately, occurs regardless of race.
There were a lot of things that Piccola did not have. Her parents had begun to drift apart and had conflict long before she was born. She was born into poverty, into an unstable home, with a father who himself had not had a very traditional upbringing. Her mother had also begun to let herself and the home fall to the wayside.
The passage where Piccola, Claudia, and Frida experience Piccola's mother at the white residence where she works is a pivotal moment in the story, tying back into the idea of white baby dolls being the ideal for all little girls. Piccola's mother, instead of comforting and helping her own daughter, comforts the little white girl whom she nannies. The house itself that their mother works in is this blinding beacon of whiteness. The level of tenderness and care for the little white girl is alarmingly absent in her interactions with her own little girl.
I mean, could her mother have been in any way responsible for what happened to Piccola?
I think that this is a perfect example of another parallel to be made between the Persephone myth and this novel. Demeter would have moved heaven and earth for her daughter and does not rest until she's returned. Alternately, Mrs. Breedlove is not really a shining example of motherhood or tenderness. Piccola is so detached from her own mother that she calls her Mrs. Breedlove. And when her mom finds that Piccola has been assaulted, she doesn't really do much and just sort of leaves her. Demeter grieves.
Y'all could not have said it any better. So let's bring it back to the impacts of Western beauty standards on the modern world and the relations of these novels.
Fact. The beauty standards that we were taught came from the twisted interpretations of the art and literature that survived from the Greeks, which were taught around the world by European colonizers.
Eurocentric ideals are so damaging and present all over the world. In the Middle East, women go under the knife to shrink their noses. And in Korea, double eyelid surgery has become a rite of passage.
In India, lightening creams are the chosen avenue to reach the Western standard of beauty.
In America, black women feel the need to straighten their curly hair just to fit into corporate America.
Piccola wanted to see the world how the pretty little blue-eyed girls saw the world, see the opportunities, be beautiful, and become a completely different person.
So let's end this discussion with a quote from the novel. Of all of the wishes people had brought him, this seemed to him the most poignant and the one most deserving of fulfillment. A little black girl who wanted to rise up out of the pit of her blackness and see the world with blue eyes.
Thanks for listening to our show today. I hope y'all learned something.